This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Over the weekend, Raleigh police stopped volunteers who were handing out meals to the needy in downtown's Moore Square. The charities were warned that distributing food without a permit violated a city ordinance. If they continued, they were told they would risk arrest. The action sparked a backlash and raised questions about public perception of homelessness and poverty in the Triangle. Colin Campbell's a reporter with the News and Observer. He has covered the latest on the situation in Raleigh. Reverend Hugh Hollowell is the director of Love Wins Ministries, one of the groups that distributes food in Moore Square on the weekends. Welcome to both of you. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Colin, tell us what happened over the weekend.
Well, over the weekend, Mr. Hollowell's ministry was out there giving out sausage biscuits and apparently was told by the police that is against a city ordinance that bans food distributions in city parks without a permit. That's an ordinance that had not been enforced up to this point, although there's some instances over the last couple months of other groups having similar problems talking to police officers around that area. And then Mr. Hollowell put a blog post up Saturday night, which went viral very quickly on social media, calling for people to contact the city council and ask for some changes about this. And the response was pretty tremendous. City council, by the end of Saturday night, had gotten dozens of emails from people concerned about the law, and one of the council members called for a special meeting that's going to take place on Wednesday to figure out sort of what went wrong here and how they can address this problem in the future. And then Sunday, there was a pretty big media presence out in Moore Square. Mayor Nancy McFarland came out, so did Councilman Russ Stevenson, to talk to some of the groups and figure out what was at issue here. Most of the people in the city council had no idea that this sort of crackdown was going to take place. So what they're looking at now is how they can perhaps change the rules or set up some sort of arrangement to make sure that these food distributions can continue out in that area and that the homeless can get the assistance that they need from these groups that want to help out.
Reverend Hollowell, is this your first weekend out there?
Oh, no. We've been doing this for every Saturday and every Sunday at 9 o'clock for 6 years.
So, and you haven't had a permit in any of that time?
No, we've never had a permit. Early on, 5.5 years ago or so, a police officer pulled us to the side and kind of wink, wink, nod, nodded, said, you shouldn't be in the park, but if you set up on the sidewalk next to the park, it's a public sidewalk, no one can ever bother you. Just make sure you keep access open and you clean up after yourself.
That was a long time ago, years ago when you first
started.
Over
5 years ago.
Haven't heard from anybody since, and then this weekend.
And then this weekend, right.
So who else is there? Set the scene for us. I mean, what do you do? How many people do you serve? What time do you get started? Tell us what goes on in Moore Square on the weekends.
Sure. Well, the first thing you have to understand is that the city of Raleigh does not have a food, a soup kitchen, rather, on Saturday or Sunday that is open to the public. And so during the week, there is. So on the weekend, there is no publicly provided food. So a number of nonprofits, such as ours, have over the years filled in the gap. And so we show up at 9 o'clock on Saturday and Sunday morning. We have huge carafes of hot coffee. We have usually 100 to 150 breakfast sandwiches. This week, it was sausage and biscuits from Bojangles. And our primary goal is to distribute food and to develop relationships with the people who are there. And we've done that, again, unmolested for over 6 years. And this week we pull up and we're confronted by a number of police officers. There are multiple police cars there. And they tell us that if we set up, that we can't set up, it won't be permitted.
Well, Colin, at the News and Observer, tell us about that, because we call the police department and ask them if they wanted to talk. They said, no, this is not our deal. This came from the city. Mayor Nancy McFarland declined to talk to us as well when she found out that Reverend Holloway would be on the program. But they said, well, we didn't know anything about this. So what do you know about where this order came from? There are a lot of police cars there, so it wasn't an accident.
Yeah, well, that's the big mystery in this whole thing, is the city council members, they say they don't know how it got started. They obviously want to get answers at the special meeting they're having tomorrow and figure out where to go from here. But I really haven't. I talked yesterday, tried to contact the Parks and Recreation Department that would oversee Moore Square. They wouldn't return my calls. The police department referred me up to the city administration, and the assistant city manager, who I was able to talk with yesterday, said simply he doesn't know where this order came from, why this sudden change in policy in terms of whether they were going to enforce this ordinance that's been on the books for ages. And obviously, has not been enforced in this area with these types of food distribution. So that's sort of the big mystery, and I think the city council is going to try to find out what prompted this on Wednesday. One thing that did happen last week was that the city took possession of the old Salvation Army building, which is right next to the square. Salvation Army has moved to much nicer digs up a few miles to the north on Capitol Boulevard, and the city has purchased that property for some redevelopment that they're planning a couple years out. The city took possession of that building and basically told some of the groups out there, including one called Church in the Woods, that they couldn't use the parking lot of that building to do their food distribution. So those groups shifted over to Moore Square and I think created some more critical mass on the square with a larger number of groups giving out food there. So that may be part of it, but we don't really know for sure because the police aren't talking.
Hugh, why not get a permit? What does it take to get a permit?
Well, I only know what the police officer told me, because he told me when we didn't have a permit, and I said, well, fine, we'll get a permit. And he said it costs $800, and they likely wouldn't approve you anyway. So, yeah. So the welcome mat said go away.
What, Colin, what do you know about the permits and who permitted for what? I mean, are these essentially designed for food trucks or this kind of distribution?
These are mostly for special events. So when you have a big street festival in Moore Square with bands, or they have a beer festival there that occurs every year, those are sort of the permits for that, so they can kind of get around some of the ordinances that may be out there on a daily basis in terms of being able to sell alcohol, sell food, that sort of thing. So the permit process really isn't designed for a small kind of DIY charity like some of the groups that come out there in Moore Square. And I think that's something the city council is going to look at in terms of trying to figure out how they can change that and tweak that so that there's a separate process for groups like Love Wins Ministries than there is for someone who's going to have a beer festival that attracts 5,000 people on a weekend.
And of course, the purchase of that property that you referred to earlier, Colin, the Salvation Army building by the city, points to something else that's going on. A lot of development going on downtown. It is moving pretty fast, and downtown is changing quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly on the east side of Moore Square, where all this is going on, there's a lot more development pressures. The city has bought the Salvation Army building. Their plan is to assemble a couple different lots there and then put out to bid for developers to try to find a project that they think will sort of fit with the growth they want to see. Ideally, something like a mixed-use apartment building, a hotel, something of that nature. And then one block to the east of that, another developer just, I think yesterday, closed on a one square block lot where he's planning to build a couple of hundred higher-end apartments on that location in what's currently just a vacant lot amid a fairly working-class neighborhood over there. So it's definitely a big change, and a lot of the people in the neighborhoods just east of downtown are worried about gentrification, that the poor may be pushed out by rising real estate prices as there's more people who want to live in the downtown area as it grows.
It certainly shows the tensions when cities develop what to do about the poorest among us, whether or not to sweep it under the rug, push people away, or actually deal with the problems. And Hugh, your website refers to a term, the term hobophobia.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. So that's our internal, the way we think about, we say that the poor are the last acceptable group that you can discriminate against. People who would never say offensive language about other groups have no problem calling a homeless man a bum. And so that's acceptable. And so what we're seeing here is truly hobophobia. It is fear of homeless people, fear of the poor. And the city of Raleigh, like Colin said, the city of Raleigh has a lot of interest in development and a lot of interest in the developers, and there's no fear of them. In fact, we're attracting them. But the greatness of a society is not judged by how well it treats its most prosperous. It's judged by how well it treats its most vulnerable.
Colin, what kind of – you talked about the special city council meetings to talk about this, figure out, first of all, where it came from and what to do next. Is there an infrastructure in Raleigh to handle these kinds of problems where the business community, the church community, nonprofits, and the city all come together and talk this over? Or are they going to have to make it up from scratch?
Well, they've done some of this in the past. There was some concern, I think, about a year or so in the past where – the city council was hearing a lot of concerns from business owners around the bus station that also adjacent to Moore Square, and they were concerned about panhandling, some people hanging around the bus station that were perhaps driving away business, or so some business owners thought, from some of the restaurants and bars and things in that area. So this tension's been around for a while, and the city council has been trying to sort of balance the needs of the poor and to make sure that people aren't pushed out of downtown based on their income or anything like that, while at the same time trying to make sure that downtown is a place that people want to come, that they won't feel like they'll be harassed by panhandlers and that sort of thing. So this has been going on for a while. And one of the council members yesterday, Marianne Baldwin, told me that she feels like now is actually a good time to really have this as a more drawn-out conversation, a community discussion, given the growth pressures that are coming a couple years out, to try to figure out just how do we balance the needs of the less fortunate with the growth pressures of downtown and trying to continue to build on the revitalization that the area has seen in the last few years. So that will be the big topic tomorrow, and it sounds like this debate is going to take much more than one meeting before it's really resolved, and I think it'll end up being a much larger issue than just where groups like Love Wins can set up on a Saturday morning to hand out biscuits.
And will there be a space for public input at this meeting, or is it is it the council members talking among themselves?
There will be a public hearing, so people can come and sign up to speak, and it's going to take place at 3 p.m. tomorrow at City Hall on West Target Street. It'll be in the council chambers, so there'll be plenty of opportunity, and the council members are eager to hear from business owners, nonprofit groups, downtown residents, anybody who's interested in this issue and finding a resolution that works for everybody.
I want to thank you both for being on the program. Colin Campbell, a reporter with the News and Observer, has covered the latest on the situation in Raleigh. Reverend Hugh Hollowell is the director of Love Wins Ministry. Ministry is one of the groups that distributes food in Moore Square on the weekends. Coming up on the program, how other North Carolina communities approach the problems of homelessness and poverty. You'll hear about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today we're talking about homelessness and poverty in the Triangle, a look at a recent police action and weekend feeding programs in Raleigh's Moore Square. Leslie Smith is a physician in Boone, North Carolina. 30 years ago, she was homeless and spent time in Moore Square in downtown Raleigh. Santana DeBerry is executive director of North Carolina's Housing Coalition. Scott Holmes is an attorney with Brock, Payne & Meese, the law firm in Durham, and represented individuals who had been charged with violating panhandling laws in Durham. He then served on a committee to revise Durham's panhandling ordinances. So, Leslie Smith, let me start with you. You were, in fact, homeless in the 1980s in Raleigh and spent a lot of time in Moore Square. What was that like for you?
This was back before the revitalization of downtown Raleigh, and Moore Square was not a pleasurable place to be. There was a lot of ivy and overgrowth and a lot of rats, so people didn't mind the homeless being there because most of the general population didn't want to hang out there.
So you were out of sight, in effect,
from
the business community and the rest. You were playing what you called the weather game out there. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the weather game. Back in the 80s, there weren't a lot of shelter beds available, particularly for women. And so you were allowed two nights every 30 days at the Raleigh Rescue Mission or five nights a month over at the Salvation Army. So if the weather was nice, you slept outside. And if the weather was going to turn cold or rainy, then you'd get in line and wait for a bed.
You moved into a house, but then you went back onto the streets. Why?
There was a lot of transition in my life back then, and it's not that I moved into a house. I went into a housing project as a boarder in somebody else's home, and I also was burned from the neck down and had a lot of open wounds, and the unsanitary conditions were a real concern with my infected skin grafts.
What was your sense of how you were perceived on the street as a person who was homeless?
Oh, it was horrible. It was a humiliating experience, and I was probably nastier than most homeless people because I was covered in bandages from my neck down to my ankles with very infected skin grafts.
And you are now a physician, so you obviously made it out and became a doctor.
And I did that through the help of organizations that reached out to the homeless and valued them and showed me what my value was as a human being, and they made me believe in myself at a time when I didn't have a lot of faith in myself.
Well, talk just a little bit more about that, because we talked about the perception others had of you, and then you just hinted at the impact that has on you when people pass you on the street and don't want to see you.
Everybody goes through hard times in their life, and a lot of people are one step away from being homeless. And just because you don't have a place to live doesn't mean you're less valuable than anybody else in this world. And that's a hard lesson to learn. And I find it appalling that society wants to cast away homeless people like they do an empty soda can, because there's a difference there. That just by the nature that you're a human being makes you something of value.
You say that now, but there was a time when you didn't even believe that about yourself.
And I didn't believe that about myself. I felt worthless because I didn't have a job. I wasn't a productive member of society. But there were others who believed in me and had enough faith that I was going to do something important in my life that they were willing to step in and feed me and clothe me and provide medicines and bandages to me. And it was a powerful statement to me. Why would people be doing this for me if I wasn't of value?
Well, Santana DeBerry, the part of Leslie's story points to the cycle of homelessness, to being out on the streets, back finding temporary housing, back on the streets. What causes these cycles for people?
Well, we know that most people end up in a housing crisis. They're really poor people, right? So extremely low-income people who have lost their home in some way, may have some chronic illness that puts them out on the street. And here in North Carolina, we have a really robust system of getting the people who are easy to get off the street off the street. And we're working a little bit harder on trying to get those folks who are chronically homeless off the street. And we don't want anybody sleeping outside in North Carolina.
Santana, when you talked about getting people who are easy to get off the street off, who are they? Why are they easy?
It is easier to get people off the street who have family. They can, while it may not be the best housing situation, they're able to bunk with family. They're able to couch surf. They're able to, if we can get people vouchers, they're able to get housing on the private market. Those people are harder. The people who are hardest to get off the street are people like Leslie probably was at the time, right, with chronic illness, mental health issues. People who are sleeping outside every night. I mean, those are people who are literally homeless.
So, Scott Holmes, we've been talking about Raleigh, which is most recently in the headlines for this, but Durham not long ago is in the headlines because of its panhandling laws, and you were representing people who had been arrested for violating the law when they were asking for money. Tell us what was going on there. What were the why were people being arrested in Durham?
Well, back in December, the city ordinance passed a revision to the ordinance that made it more difficult to ask for help in Durham. And as a result of that, folks started getting arrested for solicitation for funds or panhandling. As that came to my attention, I had been involved with representing folks charged with crimes that were essentially crimes of poverty before, and was in the network of folks who cared about the issue, and I volunteered to represent some of these people. A coalition grew among people of faith and church leaders. They engaged in some protests. They held a public meeting, and pressure came to bear on the city council to look at it again. And so I was invited to be a part of a committee of folks to revise it. As a result, I now still represent people charged with more than 40 different charges of begging that are still pending in the Durham courts. The city council has not ruled on or taken up the ordinance, the revisions yet. But the process to the changes that have been suggested have been a really extraordinary, wonderful opportunity to work with folks and come to consensus around some changes around this issue.
I want to talk about those changes and that process in a second, but to be clear, these rules are mostly around people in the streets or near the streets. So it's in roadways, people asking for help in traffic patterns. And so there were safety issues involved here, right? So tell us what the city's concern was about people in medians and highways or along the road asking for money.
Yeah, there were a lot of concerns expressed as they were trying to pass the new ordinance. Around issues of safety. They didn't want folks in medians. They didn't want folks on off-ramps. They didn't want folks in front of cars. And so they tailored some restrictions on where folks could do that. The current ordinance requires that it be on a one-way road on the passenger side at a stoplight. And once we started looking at all the different layers of restrictions, it became a very small place in Durham where you could actually ask for help. And the folks who were used to asking for help in more high-traffic areas found themselves arrested or cited to court for violating the new ordinance.
And Satana, that gets us to some of the other problems around coping with issues of poverty and homelessness, which is you can very quickly find yourself in the criminal justice process for trying to make a living, and that makes it even harder to get out of homelessness.
Yeah, sure. We don't want to create policies that criminalize being poor. I mean, there are lots of things that people are forced to do that they wouldn't normally do because they don't have anywhere else to go. And when you have a criminal record, you're not eligible for a housing voucher in many cases. Many landlords in the private market now run background checks. The internet makes that very easy. So you pay $7, run a background check on someone. You see that they have a criminal record. You refuse to rent to them. So it just compounds the problem. The criminal justice system is not set up to deal with issues of poverty, and it's sad when we use it that way.
Scott, one of the changes that came about in the discussions that you had and the process that was set up was that not everybody who gets picked up on this particular charge is going to end up in court. There's a special process set up for handling those cases.
Yeah, one of the recommendations from the Homeless Service Committee, Advisory Committee, was that folks could be referred to a community life court where different service providers could surround these folks with the different kind of services they may need to help their situation and lead them back to housing and resources. And so that was a really exciting opportunity that we hope the City Council embraces.
Tell us about the process itself. Who all came together and sat around the table to take a look at revising this ordinance?
Well, John Bowman is a local attorney who's the head of the Homeless Services Advisory Committee. And he asked a number of different folks from the community, from neighborhoods, from the churches, to come and talk about their concerns. And folks who were outspoken in favor of the changes. And so we had voices at the table from all sides.
Business community represented?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that, I mean, I have to say, I was on a task force on homelessness in Durham and was surprised to see so many people around the table from the business community, churches, nonprofits, and and certainly the shelter community. What was the only surprising thing about it was how comfortable they were with each other. They'd been at this before. They had met many, many times over these kinds of issues. So it felt to me like there was some sort of infrastructure for dealing with these problems in a sensible way. They weren't coming together for the first time in an emergency. And I wonder how much it takes, Satana, that kind of network and culture, you know, of sort of collaboration within a community to kind of sensibly handle these problems.
Sure. North Carolina's homeless services are organized into what's called continuums of care. And in the urban areas, those continuums of care are very well organized. They reach out to the business community. They reach out to the political community, churches, neighborhood groups. They know what's going on. Because really the most important thing for homeless people is to immediately get them rehoused. And so everybody needs to be involved in that effort. Durham is especially good at this because kind of the community-based nature of almost everything that happens in Durham. But the same thing happens in Charlotte. Same thing happens in Winston-Salem and Greensboro. Even in Wake County, with these issues that we're seeing now, there is a community there that has already started to mobilize around this issue and try to find solutions.
So, and what happens? I have to think the pressure is more intense as these urban areas begin their redevelopment and revitalization plans. They start to look at the hope they have for revitalizing their downtown, and then they come face to face with this. How often do we find this kind of tension in these urban areas?
Oh, it's happens every time. I mean, if you read the New York Times this weekend, there was an article about this kind of tension now in Columbia, South Carolina, as they start to experience the kind of growth that the urban areas here in North Carolina have experienced. There's really always this balance between commerce and charity, especially here in the South. Many of these downtowns have been underinvested in for decades, and so nobody really cared that there were homeless people there. Now that they're being redeveloped, you have to move the homeless people somewhere.
Leslie Smith?
And I don't understand why we have to move the homeless people somewhere. I mean, this is part of living in such a diverse society. And I think the upscale business owners and patrons of those businesses need to know what it's like for a different part of the population. And I don't think we need to separate those.
Well, and Leslie, it seems to me that as your story indicates, that the fact that we look at the business community and the charity community, right, the nonprofit community, suggests that the problem will always be what to do with them, where to put them. When we look at your story, it's like, well, wait a minute, why isn't this a business question? How many people are we losing? How many vital people who could contribute to our economy and the robustness of our regrowth and rejuvenation are lost in those communities that we're not investing in?
Absolutely. And it's not just that. It's hard to explain, but these are people with something to teach you. And the best example I can give you is when I was a student at Duke. We were discussing the free marketplace of ideas, and the professor asked if it worked. And the girl sitting next to me says, well, I wouldn't listen to the opinions of someone who flipped burgers for a living at McDonald's. And I looked at her and said, would you listen to the opinions of a homeless person? And she said, no. And I said, would you listen to the opinions of a fellow Duke student? And she said, yes. And I looked at her and said, I was homeless, and now I'm a Duke student, and the only thing that's changed is I have a roof over my head and get more showers. I'm the same person.
Yeah, I'd like to echo that. I mean, the roof, having a roof over your head is really important. And, you know, I don't want Leslie to think I was saying that we have to do something with them. We have to house people, and housing people where they are is preferable.
No, and it isn't you. It's the way the system is set up that we've got nonprofits at the table, sure, sort of doing the help. But the question comes down to, hey, how do we move people around? And so the issue then is, can we reframe the question in a way that talks about this as an investment? Does that ever happen, Scott, when you're at these tables? I mean, you're an attorney. You're also concerned with these issues of poverty in the city. Where we all start seeing this as an investment rather than as a problem that has to be solved and a place to put people who are, unsightly to the business community, as charitable as their hearts may be.
Those conversations come up and came up. My own personal kind of reaction is that I like to shift the frame even further, that, you know, we need to change our focus from the things and the materials and the investment and the profit and make our human beings our center of our culture. And that these are, I've come to know my clients. I'm friends with them. You know, we have our consultation on the side of the road. I grab a guitar. We sing some Folsom Prison Blues. I'm enriched by my relationship with these human beings who are part of my community. And the conversation around, you know, are they investments? Are they this? Are they that? They're human beings who are our neighbors, our brothers and our sisters.
So, Tana, what's the scope of the problem in North Carolina? Maybe we should talk about here in the Triangle in terms of people who are homeless and poverty. How many people are we talking about, and how is it changing? Is it growing, shrinking, flatline?
That's a good question. I mean, we do count the homeless here in North Carolina, mostly so we can reach out to have services to people. But not every agency that provides services to the homelessness participates in that count. So we don't really have a good number, but what we know is that there are increasingly more people living on with extremely low incomes that make it very difficult to afford housing in the Triangle. Rental costs here, we talk about how people should be paying 30% of what they make for their rent or their mortgage. We know that here in North Carolina, there are a couple hundred thousand people who are paying way more than that in the 50 to 60% range and so are at risk of being homeless.
And the problem, of course, for constructing this kind of housing, it's very expensive. It's hard for the private market to provide housing at sort of the lowest income and middle income levels. Even for the working poor, it's very difficult to do that because you need a higher margin as a developer. It's a risky business to get into the home building business. You need higher margins. So the private sector has a hard time providing for people who have low incomes.
Well, at the Housing Coalition, we disagree with that. We have several programs in place here just in North Carolina. There's a housing tax credit. There's a housing trust fund that helps support developers in building affordable housing across the state for people with extremely low incomes. And you can make money doing it. You can't make the kind of margins that you would make for market rate rental. That is true. But like Scott said, it's enriching. It is needed. And people pay for it. You know, they will come.
Scott, tell us briefly about this community life court. Is it that is the alternative to the criminal justice system? Is it in place yet, and what would it do?
It's not in place yet. Again, the current city code ordinance is the same ordinance that we've been arguing about. But we borrowed the idea from the outreach court in Chapel Hill in Orange County, and it would refer folks who have needs to a place where their charges could be dismissed and they could receive services instead of a criminal sanction.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Scott Holmes, an attorney with Brock Payne Meese Law Firm in Durham. He helped craft the proposal to revise Durham's panhandling ordinances. Satana DeBerry is executive director of the North Carolina Housing Coalition. Leslie Smith was homeless in Raleigh. She is now a physician in Boone, North Carolina. Thank you all for being on the program. And coming up on our show, we're going to talk to an unlikely author. Stay tuned.